Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 16, delivered on October 19, 2017. The title of this lecture is Stock.
Today, stock. I've gone through quite a bit of this in previous lectures, and this just brings it again together and consolidates what I've already said. Now, as the topic is taken on in the book, it's a little bit narrower than how I'm going to present it to you in class. And so keep that in mind. Take good lecture notes because it'll help you on a surprise quiz, on an in-class quiz. So starting off with just a few basics about stock. Equity falls into two categories, and this is review. Equity, there is preferred and there is common. Both of them represent ownership in the corporation. The difference is that preferred stock is preferred. It will get a dividend before common stock can get a dividend. And also, if it's cumulative, any past dividends that haven't been paid have to be caught up. Bear in mind, though, that the corporation technically doesn't have to pay that preferred dividend that it has stated on the preferred stock certificate. If it doesn't, it just has to sort of like are bad, and if it's cumulative, they have to catch those old dividends up. But they can't put any dividends out there to the common until the preferred is satisfied. Preferred generally doesn't have voting rights. Common stock does. And your votes for the board of directors are based upon your percentage of shares in the corporation, pretty much. And so you, if you were a small owner of stock, they would invite you to the meeting, the annual shareholders meeting. And you might be able to cause a little bit of a ruckus there if there was something that was really important, but you're not going to change anything about the corporation. Normally, what will happen is if you're an owner of common stock, you'll get a proxy card that will say, would you please give your votes to our team so we can vote on them? You'll get a proxy from the existing board of directors, management. They'll say, we want to keep the corporation going the way it is, so please sign this card so we can use your votes to vote for ourselves. You can also say, no, I'm going to go to the shareholders meeting and raise some ruckus. Interestingly, it's happened in, I don't remember it much in the 80s, but by the 90s, there were groups that would buy stock in a corporation so that they could go to the shareholders meeting and make some kind of a case for something or other. They generally didn't have enough voting power to cause any change, but they had enough that they could be listened to at the meetings for one cause or another. We don't like you, the way you are investing, you're doing operations in these countries that have bad human rights records. We don't like the way you are doing polluting things that aren't good for the earth and all that. Or there was one, I think there was a proxy, there was a small group that bought stock in corporations back in the 90s to get them to have no smoking policies in their restaurants. But those kinds of groups come and go, but know that you probably don't have hardly any power whatsoever over the management of the company, over the who's going to be on the board of directors. Now, as far as common stock goes, there are a couple of things that I want to point out here. Common stock can actually come in different flavors. There is common stock. There are some companies that have like Class A and Class B common. class, the one class would be for this old family that founded the company. They have super voting rights, like 10 votes per share in the Class A. You can never get that stock. You could not buy that. When you see that a company trading, you'll be buying and selling on like the Class B, the normal shares. So be aware that there is that kind of stock out there that has two different varieties. One where this family controls the corporation by having super voting stock, Class A. That's out there. It's not all that usual, but you will stumble across it in very old companies, industrial companies, manufacturing companies, things like that. I believe Ford. I'm not sure about Ford, but I think they have two classes of stock. So just be aware that that's out there too. Otherwise, common stock is common stock. Now, as I said, primary issue is when the company initially, originally sells the shares, and you wouldn't be able to participate in the initial sale of the shares. That would go to the investment bankers. They would buy, guaranteed, they would have a firm underwriting. You want to start a court, you want to issue common stock, okay? You would probably, you would want to do a firm underwriting. A firm underwriting. In other words, there is an investment bank that says, we will buy your shares, and then we'll sell them from our account. Now, what you'll probably do is create a syndicate of other investment banks, investment houses, and they will assist in the sale of the shares that you are guaranteeing. So the firm underwriting will have a syndicate. Now there is this document that you will see posted in financial journals. It's called a tombstone. And essentially, it is not an offer to sell nor a solicitation for an offer to buy. It's just an announcement that says XYZ Corporation is going to issue 1 million shares at $10 per share. And that's projected. They won't finalize the price until really close to when the SEC says they can do this. And then they'll have the lead underwriter and then all these, in smaller print, all of these other underwriters here. That will be the syndicate. The big print will be the lead underwriter, and then the smaller names under it will be the syndicate members that will help sell this initial issue. Up here, it will have a disclaimer. This is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation for an offer to purchase the securities noted herein. In other words, this is not an advertisement. The securities noted herein can be sold, will be sold only through the prospectus, which is the document that they that the company submits with a lot of other stuff to the SEC, and the SEC eventually qualifies and says, yes, you can use this. Now, the prospectus is, you should give me, I want to buy some of this stock, you should probably give me, you should give me that prospectus or offer it to me before I buy, so I can read through it, the financial statements, what their plan is with the money and all that kind of stuff. Before the prospectus is actually official, there can be a version of it called the red herring. It's like a draft, and it has red print on it to make sure you know that this isn't the final version of it. The red herring can be distributed minimally for investors to have a look at, but it's not the official prospectus. Once the SEC says go, then that red print is taken off and you can start distributing the prospectus in a timely manner, the real one with black print. But this tombstone comes out in papers just to let people know there's this offering. It could be stocks, bonds, weird stuff. And I'll mention some of the oddball stuff that can be sold, which was some of the stuff that I did back in the day. But anyway, that's a tombstone, okay? And under, remember, it's not a selling document. It's merely an announcement. You can't offer or try to get people to offer to buy stock until the SEC says go, until the SEC qualifies the offering. And that's the term, and I've mentioned this before. The government at all levels never approves of anything you do in business. They will qualify it. In other words, they'll say, okay, this meets the standards we have set in regulations. That means you can go. I don't know if I told your class. When I wrote prospectuses back when it was legal for me to do that kind of work, it's no longer legal. But when I wrote prospectuses, there was this process where it's a big, huge document. It's got the prospectus in the middle, and then it's got this part in front and this part in back. It's called a Form S1 or an SB1, depending on what kind of offering it is. And I submitted that for this company to the SEC so they could do an offering of stock. They came back, and this was back in the day before there was email and things like that, on my fax, 497 deficiencies. I nearly died. I called this old consultant who'd been in the business for years. I was sort of blubbering to him. He said, how many did you say? I said, 497. He said, oh, that's not bad. What? And so a lot of it was just technical things that they said, don't do this, or you didn't put this in the right place and all that. And I came back in the second round, and they gave it 5. I was surprised. I thought, you know, maybe I'd get it down to 200. It was just 5. Fixed those up, and then came this fax qualifying the offering. They said, okay, it's a go. And there's a quiet period. They said, okay, you're a go, but you have to shut your mouths now for a certain period of time before you can start doing this. Of course, there was also the states. You had to also register with the states, too. You can't. The feds will say, okay. But then any state in which there is going to be an offer to sell or a solicitation for an offer to purchase, you have to get their divisions of securities to say okay as well. A lot of them, well, I shouldn't say, I don't know what it is now. Back in that time, many of them would just, if the SEC said it was okay, they said it was okay. But then there were some states that had real, they were jerks. They would say, well, it might meet the SEC's requirements, but it doesn't meet ours. And then you'd have to dance around, fix it for them, then send it back to the SEC and say, Florida bitched at me about this, so I've got to fix it for them. Are we still okay here at the SEC? It was a ping-pong process back then. And eventually, but there's warning on this, is that... Just very briefly, I've gotten my offering qualified by the SEC, and I've got it in, let's say, 18 states. I'm not going to worry about other states. It's just a nightmare trying to clean up every state in the union. Okay, I've gotten mine qualified in every state that I'm interested in selling. I didn't look to Illinois. You're a citizen of Illinois. You're in Kentucky, hanging out with your relatives in Kentucky. I tell you about this offering of stock I've got to your Kentucky relatives. You hear about it and you think, well, maybe I'll buy some of that. I have just violated the law because you were a citizen of Illinois. And I, even if it was back in that time, even if it was just an incidental, because there was an offer to sell or a solicitation for an offer to purchase, and you were an active participant in the conversation, bad news. That would be bad news. Famous story. There were a couple of investment bankers. They were sitting at a dinner and they were taking notes on an offering a company was going to do. And they were writing them down on napkins and all of this kind of stuff. And when the meal was over, they left and left the napkins there. Waitress picked them up, saw what was on them, acted on the information. Ultimately, those investment bankers were burned very badly because what they had done under the rules was they had written a defective prospectus. It was an unqualified defective prospectus which was published because it was allowed to be where someone else could see it. So it's really scary out there, and trying to keep everyone quiet, especially during the quiet period. Shut up. They told us we are okay, but we've got to be quiet. Don't go telling your relatives and your friends and all that kind of stuff what's about to happen. Anyway, that's a little of the background on this whole thing with common stock and offering. Okay, the secondary market is where you will probably buy your stock. Well, you will buy your stock in the secondary market. In other words, it's no longer the company that's involved in this. It's just you own stock, you want to sell it. I don't own stock, I want to buy it. So you go call your broker and you say, I want to sell 1,000 shares of XYZ. Well, I happen to have a broker somewhere else and I'd like to buy 1,000 shares of XYZ. It matches. There's a if it's a New York Stock Exchange stock, there's a floor broker. He takes orders from his masters in the various houses around the country. Okay, we've got an order to sell XYZ. I'm a floor broker. I have an inventory of that stock. I trade in that stock. I'm licensed by the NYSE to be there. So what's going to happen is the floor broker is going to just go someone a runner for the for your run your broker's runner going to run up and he's going to say I've got 1,000 shares to sell. And I'm going to say okay. And then at the same time a broker for you is going to be up there somewhere saying I need 1,000 shares. So they come through me and it's done. Within a millisecond, it can happen. Now, if you're a small-time player, you would be overwhelmed and eaten alive by the monsters who are buying and selling giant blocks of stock. However, there is a system in place in the on the NYSE and other places called the Superbook Display System. Superbook Display System. This allows small orders to get to the front of the line. Okay, small orders. Small can be rather large, but the Superbook Display System allows the small investors to have a decent shot at the deal. Okay, now this replaced a system before that called SuperDot. And back in my time, it was before SuperDot, there was something called SOES, the Small Order Entry System, SOES. Now, there are several versions of this system that's in place now. But do know that you can get your shot at an order before the big dogs eat it alive. Here's the thing. Let me bring one up here. Archer Daniels Midland. You give me the order to sell at 43.05 or better. 1,000 shares, 43.05 or better. Your broker comes, a runner for your broker comes to the floor and says to me, I need to sell 1,000 at 43.05 or better. Not going to work right now. Not going to work. I've got on this right now. I'm not going to do anything better than 42.99. So you're going to have to wait because you've been given a limit order, 43.05 or better. I really want to get rid of your stock. I'm tired of you. But I can't because you gave me a 43.05. So I'm going to just sit there. What am I supposed to do here? Okay. That's a limit order. It keeps you from selling at a price below what you want. I would strongly recommend that you never put in an order without a limit on it. If you say, sell my stock at market, that I can sell at whatever price is there. 42.99, you gave me at market, that's what I can do, 42.99. So there you go.
That's an at market order. If you don't give a limit, it is at market. You assume. So unless you want some surprise, suppose between the time you call your house and the time that runner gets to me on the floor, the price has collapsed. You're going to get that bad price. I guarantee you. Guarantee you. So unless you put a limit on that order, it's going to sit there, or rather, it's going to go right through the system like grease, no matter what has happened to the price of the stock. That's a limit order. Now, you put a limit order on yours. You said, I want to buy this at 43 or better. 43 or better on a buy means that it would be below anything below 43, buy it at. So probably you're going to get your order filled. Right now, the way it looks right at this time on the market, you're going to get your order filled because I can make you happy, okay? I can buy it at 43. Maybe. But you're going to just sit there, and I'm just going to walk away from that one. I'm going to say, all right, put it in your limit order book. You've got an order 43 or better for us, 43.05 or better for a sell. That goes into the limit order book. It doesn't get closed until it gets to that or until the transaction is pulled by you or the time limit on the order goes away. Okay? Again, though, the bottom line is don't put in orders at market unless you want to have a surprise every now and then in your life. And realistically, stable stocks, if you're trading, you're probably trading because of some information you've gotten. That is probably a time when you would want to put in a limit on the order, because information can surprise you how the market reacts to it. If you're doing a trade just for normal purposes, at market is probably not going to hurt you. But just to be on the safe side, be a smart investor, put in limit orders, okay? Now, I mentioned the limit order book. That's a book that puts all of what's going on that is pending right there for everyone on the planet to see. These are transparent books. We can all see them. The floor brokers can see them. Everyone, even the Lord himself, can see these. That is different from what I told you about earlier, where a lot of trades are now happening in the dark pools, where they don't show up on the limit order books. We don't know what that action is until it's all over. And everyone says, huh? What happened there? Why did the price do that? Oh, that was something coming out of the dark pools and smacking us around a little bit. See the on-balance volume there? That's on-balance volume. Now, again, I've told you these things before. There's OBV right there, on balance volume. That is the volume that is from the limit order book. That's the volume that's from the limit order book. That does not mean that's the whole story. Oh, a mother's work is never done. Now, what else did I want? Oh, look, different stock exchanges work different ways. Like I said, the NASDAQ is purely electronic. It is a cyberspace platform. It was around before there was such a thing as the internet. Before your time, God, it's just scaring the heck out of me that you guys are probably... you never lived at a time before there was an internet. Before there was an internet, which realistically it came into existence in the early 90s, there were a couple of members of Congress who saw that this was going to be a big thing, and they got all of their fellow senators and representatives who were from the Stone Age to put $5 billion into upgrading the telecommunication system of the country to allow for this thing called the internet to happen. Before the internet, there were internets with a small I. The most common one was called ARPANET. ARPANET was a communication system. It was sort of like the internet, except we didn't put data cleanly in pretty pages. We threw data back and forth in packages called files. And so it was what we call an FTP, a file transfer protocol. You guys see all these web pages that are almost always HTTP, hypertext transfer protocol. In other words, code that makes pretty pages. Back in the early, before that, it was packages that just files back and forth. ARPANET was, I've got to be a little careful about this. ARPANET was related to the electronic trading system of that era, before the internet. And but it's been around. NASDAQ has been an electronic platform for a long, long time. And now, and so essentially, you've got market makers who will buy and sell specific stocks, just like on the AMEX and the New York Stock Exchange, except that it's all electronic, and it's so sophisticated, orders are just filled and matched, if they can be, in blinding speed these days. Now, I want to bring up something about the AMEX. And this requires that I bring up a couple of legal terms to you that sort of take you away from what most people know about these words. I'm going to distinguish between a broker, an agent, and a dealer. In technical business terms, a broker represents the buyer. An agent represents the seller. A dealer represents himself or herself. So, when you buy your insurance, you go to your insurance agent. The agent represents the insurance companies. We represent you. Bull crap. No, they don't. They are representing insurance companies. You buy a house from a real estate agent. The agent is going to represent the person selling the house, not you. You could actually go to a real estate broker, and that broker would represent you to buy a house negotiating with an agent for the seller. Most people don't know that distinction, though. Now, the Realtors Association will say, well, it's a little more complicated than that. We can't. No. Now, you go to a car dealer represents himself or herself, buys inventory, and then sells it on his book. And he can represent a lot of different car companies. Here in town, there are several, like they're doing a really nice big upgrade to one out there at the corner of Rab and, it's Fort Jesse and Towanda. That, you'll see all kinds of cars, Subaru, Toyota, VW, Mercedes, Lincoln. The dealer represents himself. He does not represent a car company. He represents himself. Okay, now, when you go to a stock broker, he represents you as the buyer. When you buy, he is legally duty-bound to represent your interest. And there are compliance officers crawling in brokerage houses, especially anymore, to make sure that those brokers there are representing your best interest. Sometimes not exactly what you want. If they see that you're doing something really stupid, they have a duty to warn you. And that's why, well, I don't use brokers. I don't pay those commissions. I just do things myself on these. Well, good for you. Those guys have gotten a hellacious amount of training, passed some killer license exams, and they're watched over like hawks by compliance. And so if you think you're going to be better than they are and you don't need to, you're going to save yourself a few bucks, by all means, do it on your own. but these brokers, they do represent your interest in the transactions. Now, in the world of stock, like on the Amex, there are these specialists, these islands. Well, it's a little different. But there are these places, these locations on the floor, literally on the floor. They buy and sell for their own pocket. Now, they have, there are maybe this guy over here, 50. He specializes in 50 companies. So if I, or this guy over here, there's 30 companies. This guy over here, 100. So if you are a runner and you've been given an order, you look for the specialist that deals in that stock, knowing full well that that dealer is going to be working for his own pocket. Keep that in mind on some exchanges. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to screw you, but he's sure as hell not going to give you the deal of the century. It can get pretty rough on those floors, the yelling and the... I don't know what it is like now, though I haven't been in that since it's no longer fun. Okay, that's... Know the difference. The broker will represent you. Now, the floor, the floor broker... on the New York Stock Exchange, it's just a little bit different from how it is on the Amex. And I do have to make a note here. I bring up the New York Stock Exchange. That's a big one. The American Stock Exchange, Amex, that's a biggie. The NASDAQ is just like huge. New York Stock Exchange deals in companies that are very big, very strong. They go through hell to get the NYSE to list them. Amex, the same way. Back in my time, I got pretty good at getting companies listed on the NASDAQ. But they are very tight. I've told you the stories, but the Amex, I got only one company ever listed on Amex. I don't even know if it's still there. I try not to look anymore. But... tight requirements, high standards. So NYSE, Amex, NASDAQ. Now, a couple of others I should mention. Internationally, the Nikkei, N-I-K-K-E-I, Nikkei. That's the Japanese. Now, in Europe, there are exchanges too. They're not called exchanges. They're called bourses, B-O-U-R-S-E, a bourse. Now, interestingly enough, a European company's stock can sort of trade on a big exchange in the United States. But what you're buying is not direct stock if you're buying the stock of another country. You're buying what is called an ADR, an American Depository Receipt. If you see a European company listed on the New York Stock Exchange, that ain't that company. That's an ADR, which is backed by the actual stock of that company. A German company, GmbH, some GmbH company, might be, you see a stock here on the NYSE, that isn't the stock, that's an ADR. American. It's essentially the same, but just know that there's that one step of removal in there. The other exchanges, the Hang. I think it's H-A-N-G, Hang. And you can trade on these as an American citizen, but it's a little bit it's a little more complicated, but I wouldn't do it myself, but I've been told that it's kind of like pretty transparent to you if you're going to do that kind of stuff. The broker might bitch at you, but it's not that hard, I guess. And I'm honest with you. If I know what's going on, I'll tell you. If I don't, you get these disclaimers. I don't do this myself. Okay. Now, also, there are other exchanges in the United States most people don't even know about or they don't think about. And I've actually had some companies listed I had back in the day. They are regional exchanges. Like there's one, the Philadelphia Exchange. that is actually a fair, there are companies listed there. So you can look into these regionals. People always seem to look at the NYSC or the Standard Poor's 500 or the Wilshire. You look at these stocks and, yeah, this is the stock market I'm looking at. There's a whole world out there of these companies that are on these regional exchanges. Those exchanges have been trading since the beginning of time, almost. Interestingly, there are some famous stories, and I don't know the extent to which they're true, but back before there was electronic communication, even before there was Morse code and, you know, keying and all that, these exchanges were working, and they were actually communicating with each other across hundreds of miles. And it wasn't on horses. In many cases, in some cases, there were actually light towers that were used to transmit information between exchanges. And there were lightmen who were up there doing that. There are even rumors and stories about lightmen being killed so that dirty dealers could get up there and get the signals and not send them on and then trade on what was being sent in the signals. And I've heard those stories persistently, and I don't know whether they're urban legend or not, but it kind of makes sense that they would do that because there could be some pretty serious money made playing that kind of game. But anyway... Now, I wanted to go back, before I finish here, with firm underwriting. I get you to sell my stock. I'm done. You give me your money. You take a nice chunk for yourselves, which is why new equity has a higher cost of capital, component cost of capital, than existing equity. Equity has a cost to the company. It's a higher cost than the cost of debt. Which kind of leaves us with this question, why in the world would anyone use equity? But they do. We'll talk about that later. But new equity, you're going to give me money, minus your commissions and your fees and your consultants and all that kind of crap. And then I got the money and I can go on with my life. Okay? However, that's not how it always works. A firm underwriting is the dream ticket. The biggie companies do it. But the other kind is what is called a best, the next kind is called a best efforts underwriting. A best efforts underwriting, I come to you and you say, no, we're not going to give you the money. We will contract with you to try to sell your stock. But there are no guarantees in this one. That's a best efforts underwriting. Sometimes it's called a Western style. Because it's not what the East Coast boys do. A Western style underwriting. I did best efforts. Yeah, your company needs $1 million. Okay, we'll contract with you. We'll do what we possibly can. We're going to soak you like you were in a bathtub because this is hard. But we're going to try to do it for you. And then I would form a syndicate. All right, folks, we can make a decent penny off this desperate company if we can unload $1 million of a stock. They want to go off at $5 a share, so we've got $200,000 a share to sell. I'm going to take $100,000. You want 20, you want 20, you want 20, you want 10, 10, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. Okay, we've got it. We're going to try to do it. No promises, so. And we're going to take a nasty commission. The company's probably going to come out with
something like about $800,000. And I'm covering this because that's not something that would be nice.
Greed and all of that, you understand. But it's not just greed. I'm sticking my neck out. Because once we've sold that stock, that's our crippled little monster. Because when people realize that it wasn't a good buy, they're going to try to sell it back to us, and we're going to try after then. We thought we sold it. It's going to come back in our faces over the next months, and we're going to try to find other suckers to buy it. I can't believe I'm saying that. Oh, I'm going to edit this out. Yeah. Okay, now there's one last one. It's called the self-underwriting. Now, there is sometimes when these two, a best and a self, are kind of blended. A self-underwriting is when the company officials themselves try to sell their stock. That is a world of danger. Because in order to do that, you still have to do all the stuff with the SEC and the Fed and the states that are necessary, but then there you are. Excuse me. Kind of like, okay, this is a little bit tricky. These guys are doing things that could get them wiped out, thrown in jail, thrown in prison, because they just don't know better. One of my best stories about this happened many years, well, it has, I hate saying many years ago, what it really was many years ago. A long time ago, this company in Akron, Ohio, it was started by a guy who had been an NOC for the CIA, and he had a couple of engineers who were working with him. One of them was a volunteer firefighter in a suburb of Akron. The other one was sort of like just this early computer geek back in the 80s. And they had designed a system that this NOC had seen at the, from his work with the CIA. And essentially what they did was they had created the first real holograms. I mean, these were things they showed, the demonstration they showed me was of a Budweiser can, huge, just spinning in the air, not, it was just an image, rotating. You could walk around it and look at it from different angles. It was just amazing what they did. In order to do this, they had to put, they had to have extreme stability of these cameras that they were using and these video things. They weren't, they were film. And they put a pier 60 feet into the ground, a concrete pier, for the stability of the cameras to do the imaging for this thing. They had all kinds of other ideas, and they had already prototyped one that was like, before there were MRIs, this was an MRI. It was basically a way to image a person's heart so that they could then have doctors around the world look at this heart and tell the surgeons who were going to work on it about what they were seeing that might be in something to watch out for and all that. Okay, they needed $5 million. And there was a way to do that on a limited, restricted basis. It was called a Reg A offer. I did paperwork for them, got everything together. Well, the Ohio Division of Securities got curious about these rumors of these guys up in suburban Akron selling stock on their own. And they interviewed them. And these guys were just innocent puppies. They didn't ask for legal counsel. We're not doing anything wrong. We'll just talk. Sure, we'll talk to you. So they asked the one guy, are you taking any salary from this money that you're raising? That's a big no-no. Well, I mean, we got to eat, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. That was the end of the company. Last time I went up there, the doors were shut. The people were all in prison. And that technology just went away. And of course, it was absorbed by another company. I saw that four or five times where companies were shut down for one reason or another and their technology shows up years later somewhere else, curiously enough. But anyway, watch it. If you're going to do your own sale of stock, know the rules, like the back of your hand, because there are a lot of people at the state level who are ambitious and they want to put a feather in their cap by nailing you. A little angst coming back from the years. You're not going to sell that stock. Nope. Should have put in your limit a little lower. I could have done you some good. See, she's still sitting on the limit order book. Do you see it? She's still parked on the limit order book. You're just sitting there. Yeah, I got my stock. Yeah, but she is. You're just going to have to call, cancel the order, resubmit the order at a lower level, if you really need the money. If you don't, you're just going to say FTS. I'll sit on this. Fancy that scenario. FTS. That's what FTS means. Okay. Okay. Got it. Okay. Good. But also, again, keep in mind the regional exchanges. Always remember the difference between a broker and an agent and a dealer. And it doesn't hurt you to keep that in mind when you go into your own world as a professional and as a full-blown independent adult, that these actually do have legal meaning, broker, agent, dealer. And in the stock markets isn't the only place where this plays out. Everything from real estate to cars and all of that, it depends on what you are. It depends on what you need, whether you're going to be willing to work with a broker, an agent, or a dealer. There are actually, for fleets of vehicles, there are brokers. There are fleet brokers. So if you want to buy a substantial number of vehicles, you would probably go through a broker who would represent your interest to a dealer or to actually the company itself. So there are times when average people would deal with an agent or a dealer, but if you've got enough market power, you are with a broker. That's why when I tell you about insurance, I don't really want any of you to be work as a receptionist in a personal lines agency. However, there's a whole world of insurance where it's all brokering. You and your company represent the buyer of the insurance. You figure out all their risks. You get a look at everything going on with the company. And then what your people do is go to the agents or the company, the insurance companies themselves, and you say, all right, which parts of this risk exposure platform can you insure and how much? Which parts can you insure and how much? Your job is to get the best deal possible for the company you represent. And that means in many cases you are going to try to lock the market. You're an insurance company, and I'm the broker for his company. I'm going to talk to you, and I'm going to say, all right, are you willing to work with me on this? And you say, yeah. So I want you to sign a BOR, a broker of record letter. You are mine for this deal. So that when she comes, she was trying to get that company to go with her brokerage. I've locked the market because I've gotten you. You follow the trick? That's commercial insurance brokering. If you're interested in it, talk to me. We have one of the heaviest of the insurance schools in the nation right here at Illinois State. And they are very interested, the director's very interested in getting people into commercial brokering. It's not insurance. It's sort of like sales logic, looking at all the risks and seeing what those risks are, even the ones the company doesn't see. And taught in dealing and negotiations and all that. Anyway, now, getting that off the board. And I've done this one before, and this is just a refresher for you. Is that what you make on stock comprises two pieces. There is the dividend, and there is the capital gain. The capital gain is the appreciation in price over the holding period. The capital gain is the appreciation in price over the holding period. The dividend is how much money they pay you in dividends over the holding period. So, if I wanted to say, all right, total yield, it would be
the dividend somewhere between period zero and period one that you got over the price that you paid, plus the price that you sold it at over the price you paid. So in other words, the dividend sometime between period zero and period one that you got, plus the price at which you unloaded it at period one, divided by the price at period zero. Now, if that's exactly a year, that's an annual yield. If it's not exactly a year, you have to annualize it. So in other words, what I might do is, let's say that you buy ACN on 15 June 2016, okay? You sell ACN on 28 October 2017 you bought ACN at 13.22. You sold ACN at 14.96, and during the period ACN issued a dividend of 28 cents. Now, notice this isn't a perfect year, so if we want the annualized yield, what we're going to have to do, first things first here, we've got a dividend of 28 cents. Plus, when we unload it, we pulled 14.96. And dividing that by 13.22, I can't even see my own writing. There's our total yield, So whacking that thing down, I'm going to honk this on the calculator, and I'm going to say, all right, I've got open parenthesis, 28 plus 14.96 close the parentheses, divided by 13.22, oh, I do apologize. Minus one. So our gain over the period is 15.27%. 15.28%. However, that is more than a year. So the next thing we have to do is annualize it. And that, when I showed you how to do this, we'll go and find a days between dates, and a date duration calculator. So what we need to find is 15 June, that 15 June of 2016, and the end date would be October. The 28th, is there some reason why, there we go, 2017, okay, calculate the duration, 132 days, okay, 132, is that only, wait. Boy, that ticks me off. See? Thank you. I knew that couldn't be right. Okay, calculate. 497 days. Okay, so now what we need to do is take 497 days and turn that into an annual value. Can someone please keep that one in mind? Well, I should be able to store that. Memory plus. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take 497 divided by 365 equals 1.3616 years. So that was 1.3616 years. Now remember the formula? I'm going to take 1 plus the total yield to the power 1 over the number of years minus 1. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to recall that, memory recall, plus 1 equals, and then I'm going to raise that, to the 1 over, open parentheses, 1 divided by 1.3616, close the parentheses, minus 1. Yield is 48%. I'm going to do that again. That looks a little suspicious to me. 1 plus, let me do that again just to make sure, memory recall, equals. Now let me raise that to the, open parenthesis, 1 divided by 1.3616, close the parenthesis, equals, oh, there we go. I must have keyed something in wrong. That did look awful. Yeah, your yield, your annualized earning yield on that was almost dead on 11%, 11.01%. You got it? So this is, and then that gives you a way to compare this to other investments you've made on an annualized basis. Because you could be buying stocks and selling stocks on a continuing basis. So what this does is it gives you the ability to compare apples to apples with your annualized yield. Now, the last thing. What I want to do here you need to know that for this weekend. Okay? You just need to know that for this weekend.
And I'm going to show you something else here that's worth your while. Okay. This is a screen that's got information on it. It's called statistics. And I'm going to actually teach you guys about short selling stocks. And you've got some information here. But it's got some quick, dirty information on it that's worth your while to know. All you have to do is know this and be able to tell me this. What you see here is, of course, I gave you, backing up here. The front screen is going to help you with some things. And then the statistics screen is going to help you with some other things. Be careful with looking. Go to Edgar for financials. Because like I've said before, you can get some glitches that are persistent in the way they're pulling their information from Edgar. But sometimes the numbers aren't right. So I wouldn't pull financial information from here. But there's other information too. By the way, here's some very nice data that's worth you knowing as well. For other classes you might take, just some stuff that you can see, and you can name different time periods you want. It's worth it for you to know, not for this class, but for other things where they might want you to look at stock stuff. That's all I have for you. I thank you.